and welcome to this Talis podcast with your host, Paul Miller. Clayton Christensen's ideas of disruptive innovation are well known in the business space. In Disrupting Class, his latest book, Clayton Christensen, together with co-authors Michael Horn and Curtis Johnson, applies some of these ideas to compulsory education. In this podcast, I talk with Michael Horn and Curtis Johnson. We discuss the book, the application of ideas to the compulsory education space, and then we extrapolate from there and begin to explore what this might mean for higher education. For more information on this show and others in the series, please see the show notes on our website. Thank you. Hello and welcome to this latest podcast. Today I'm joined by Michael Horn and Curtis Johnson, two of the authors on the recent book Disrupting Class. Before we get into a little bit of detail about the book and some of the issues around it, I'll first ask them to briefly introduce themselves so that you have an idea of where they've come from and also so that you can associate names with voices. So first of all, to Michael. Hello, Michael, and thank you very much for taking the time to join me today.
It's a pleasure to be here. So I came to this project. I was actually a business school student in one of Clay's classes and was just blown away by the theories of disruptive innovation that he's espoused in helping organizations to innovate. And when he had this project to work with him on writing a book about public education, I just jumped at the opportunity, and I brought a public policy background to the question, and combined with the business school understanding of his theories, and it was just a delight to work on it.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And Curtis. Hello, Curtis.
Hi there. In contrast to Michael, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm a former teacher and a college president, and I spent most of the last quarter century writing for newspapers and magazines about a wide range of public policy issues. I've also been very much involved with a national network that we call Education Evolving. And that it was really through that I got interested in this particular project, and that's the way I met Clay Christensen.
Okay, sounds good. Now, this book, and I'll provide links to it in the show notes, Disrupting Class. We were talking a little bit before the recorder turned on about how the project came together. Could you share a little bit of information about that?
Well, I already mentioned the Education Evolving Network. I think for a long time, Clay Christensen had in his mind that the research he'd done over the last 20 years across many industries in looking at innovation and how it happens and disruption when it occurs would probably apply to anything that was an industry. And it probably became a later thought that sectors like education or healthcare were also organized as industries, and they behaved like industries. And somehow this group of education reformists managed to converge on a path with Clay Christensen, and he said, we absolutely have to do a book about this.
Okay, and you did. Before we go any further into that, I guess for anyone out there who's had their head in the sand and doesn't know what disruptive innovation is, Michael, with that business school background, what's disruptive innovation?
Great question. It's actually an interesting term because it seems to imply a breakthrough improvement or something like that, but it's nothing of the sort, actually. Disruptive innovation is one that transforms an existing market or creates a new one by actually being simpler and more convenient and more accessible and more affordable than the existing product or service, which was previously complicated or expensive and inaccessible. And a disruptive innovation is initially formed in a narrow foothold market, so it appears unattractive or inconsequential to the industry incumbents. And there it gets its foothold, starts to improve, and ultimately starts to take applications from the complicated things into the simple application or product and transform the world in that way.
And what would some examples of that be?
The scope of business history is just littered with examples from the personal computer, which was disruptive relative to the mainframe or mini computers of the times, to the Toyota cars that are disruptive relative to Ford and GM and Chrysler. So we see it all over the place, and Google's now doing it, and Linux is disrupting the Microsoft Windows operating system, and on and on.
Okay, so it's not simply, I guess, going back to the computer example, it's not simply that a PC is in some way better than the mini computer that was there before. There's actually something else going on.
PCs were pretty awful when they were first introduced, just like the first transistor radio had lousy voice quality to it. As Michael was implying, the disruption, when it appears, often looks quite inferior, and it only appeals to people who aren't being served by a dominant product.
Yeah, that's just right, and that's why you saw the personal computer when Apple and some of the other companies burst on the scene. They found success in marketing it as a toy, actually, to children, because they couldn't possibly sell such a crummy product to the corporate customers of the mini computers and mainframes.
Right, so it's about finding a different niche and then growing from that niche.
That's exactly right, and we tend to call that, we have a somewhat fancy name for it that sometimes is confusing. It's called non-consumption, and all it really means is where the consumers have no alternative to the product that you're giving them, and so they're just delighted with something that, yeah, might be seen as inferior, but for them it just makes something that they're trying to get done much more convenient and affordable.
Okay, and as we alluded, there have been a number of books that have laid out these ideas and built them. There's been The Innovator's Dilemma, The Innovator's Solution, which I'll put links to in the show notes, and then a number of research papers and things as well. And this has all tended to focus on the business sector. So why take that? And Curtis, you were beginning to answer this question at the beginning. Why take that and apply it to compulsory education in the United States? Are you suggesting that the United States school children are products to be innovated around?
Well, to begin with, you have to make the leap to agree with us that schools are an industry too. They're people organized in such a way that they have ways they've learned of doing things that form an organizational culture, and it becomes a kind of what we would think of as almost a trap that you really cannot get out of and leaves you vulnerable to disruption. As to why do it, I think it's because we've agreed it may be this nation's most important challenge, ranking right up there with climate change and energy sources. And the awful truth is that we're losing about half the kids. And if you think of schools as an industry, it used to be an access industry where the drill was you had to provide an opportunity for people to get to a good education. But we have shifted first subtly and then even by federal statute in the early part of this century to say that schools are no longer an access industry, they're an achievement industry. And for kids these days to have any hope of success in a 21st century economy, not to mention trying to forge a society that works, every kid is going to have to achieve according to their ability. So the idea of just losing 40 or 50% of them just because school's too hard and they fall behind, they get bewildered, they disappear, or school's too boring and rigid and hierarchical and they mentally drop out, we just can't afford that anymore. So it was very timely to see that if disruption is happening in the school industry, you really ought to call attention to it.
Okay, and what are some of the examples of the ways that the ideas do apply to the school sector then? Surely there's a formal curriculum that everyone goes through. There are exams at the end. There's a whole series of federal and state regulations to guide all of that. Where's the scope for disruption?
It's a great question. It's one of the first mysteries that people, when they look at this, they say, well, if you look at the U.S., it's all required. Almost everyone goes to school. How could there possibly be that zone of non-consumption that you guys both talk about? And I think that's right at the surface. But when you dive a little bit deeper, you see vast pockets of non-consumption. And one of the biggest ones is what Kurt alluded to there was the vast numbers of dropout students, particularly in urban areas that are just desperate for an option. But you also see within schools, such as high school, the lack of advanced courses that are offered because they don't have enough teachers that are qualified, or for other resource reasons. To credit recovery, students fail a course, and in many urban school districts, because of the way the school system is set up, they just have to move on. So if they failed algebra, they just have to take geometry, even though they'll need that algebra class to graduate and understand future concepts. And there's just no option for them. So there's a lot of opportunity for a disruption to come in, and that's what we're seeing happen, actually. We're seeing a lot of online learning and computer-based learning, what we call student-centric technology, starting to take root and really transform the way education happens. And this is from private companies like Apex Learning and K-12 to governmental organizations like Florida Virtual School, for example.
Okay. So the ideas around innovation and disruptive innovation, as we said, grew up in a business environment, and you've taken them up and applied them to formal education. Were there particular problems in applying business ideas to education, or did they fit reasonably well, and it was simply a case of finding new educational case studies to replace the case studies of mainframes and minicomputers?
Yeah, another good question, and I think we'd all say that education certainly has many unique facets to it, and people have been quick to point out that in the U.S., again, it's highly regulated, and of course, it's first and foremost something that you alluded to. It's about the future of children, and thus the future of our country as well. So the stakes are high. And it also has certain elements that have made the market historically difficult to penetrate and lasting reform hard to come by. But from the chartering laws that have started to come in to a lot of the disruptions that I just alluded to with the online learning, you're starting to see that change, and you're starting to see pathways that really suggest, you know, it's maybe not so different. And the lenses of innovation that we're talking about really isn't just about businesses per se. It's about how any organization can innovate successfully, and the forces at work in schools and districts are really the same as those as in other organizations. So for me anyway, I think the most surprising thing was how much it did apply.
Yeah, and Paul, some of this isn't just a matter of applying what business research implies for schools. Some of it is just common sense, that when you see how different kids are today, both from each other and from previous generations, how crazy is it to think we should perpetuate the batch processing teacher-centric model where we line all these kids up in rows and we put an adult in front of them who's supposed to represent all the relevant knowledge that's been divided into subjects and organized into courses and put in proper school sequence and through the process of something we call instruction given to these kids who can then confirm that they got it on some kind of standardized test within some reasonable period of time. We've got so many different learning styles, different aptitudes, different ways of learning, and the book tries to shine a really good light on that and then makes a strong case that the only rational response is to customize learning. And if you agree with that, the only affordable way to do it is to use what technology today makes possible. Turn the teacher into a coach and what we call a content architect, and not that vessel from which all knowledge flows.
I'm sorry, that's not fair. We had to go through the old system. We had to do it that way. Why shouldn't our children suffer too?
Well, it worked for a lot of us. That's right. But the problem is that because it worked for us and we are the sort of the professorial class, we assume that the way we got it is the way everybody else is going to get it, and the numbers tell a different story.
And the other interesting thing off that is what Kurt, again, alluded to earlier, which was the dropout situation and the change with the laws requiring us to educate all students now to a basic level, which is not something that the system has ever done or was built to do. And so that's a very different question and problem, and now you're really having to say, hey, we have to figure out how to educate all these children so that they can maximize their human potential and be vibrant parts of our society.
Okay, and there, you're arguing, and the evidence supports you, that there is no single pedagogical format that will suit all children all the time.
Right.
That's exactly right, and you can just...
has been a problem movement. Yeah, in the reform movement for at least a generation now. It's been an almost relentless search for the silver bullet, for the one best practice, and then we'll just tell everybody to do that. And the wonderful truth is you don't need to do it and you shouldn't want to do it, that it isn't the same thing for every kid.
Okay, good. So a lot of the case studies in the book are drawn from the previous research, mainly in the industry sector, so things like the mini computer and Toyota cars and some of the ones we've mentioned. There are a number of scenarios that run through the book, though, that are focused on education and how a number of students and their parents and their teachers change and benefit from what you're suggesting. Where's the disruption going to come from, though? We've already talked about this educational system as quite tightly enmeshed. So who moves first? Do the teachers, the parents, the school board, government, educational technology providers like Blackboard? Or is it going to come from completely outside the system? Is someone like Microsoft or Google going to step in and smash what's there and disrupt so visibly and so dramatically that everything sort of falls into place behind them?
Well, I think one of the things about a disruptive innovation is that it doesn't change the world overnight. And so that's important to think about right from the start, is that we're not going to see something smash through and just flip the system on, and all of a sudden everything will be fixed. The neat part about a disruptive innovation is it starts at the fringes, so to speak, goes around the system and reforms it in that way. And it's a gradual process. And it is happening. We already see it happening. And so the question is, sure, where? And it's a lot of different actors starting to participate in it. You have the for-profit companies that I mentioned earlier, Apex Learning, K-12, players like that. There's plenty of others. You have districts and states wisening up to the fact that, as Kurt mentioned before, they're going to have to deal with this reality. And so a lot of them are setting up zones of innovation where they can do it themselves, whether that looks like chartered schools or pilot schools. That's been one action that they've taken. But they've also done disruption with schools within schools. And so they've brought the online learning actually into their classrooms to help out with the credit recovery programs and so forth. They've also set up alternative schools to educate people who weren't going through the traditional system and get that content and that learning experience delivered almost exclusively online. So you're seeing it happen from a lot of parties. One of the interesting questions is, how does it continue to unfold? And Kurt, Clay, and I have a theory or a hypothesis that we'll see what we call user networks start to emerge. And these are sort of like eBays or Amazons, where participants will put things into the user network and other people will draw it back down. And that will, we think, be driven by parents, students, and teachers who really just want to teach a certain concept in a different way so that other people in their class or in their family or among their friends will be able to get a concept because they learn just differently. And over time, as this content comes on board, users will rate it and say it works best for this type of learning and so forth. And that will really customize the learning over time.
Yeah, and
that will be a pull mechanism. I should add that people will start demanding that and looking for it outside of the school system.
And to circle back to something we implied earlier, that the disruption almost always looks not very good at first. People are inclined today to say, "Oh, these guys don't know what they're talking about. I've seen some of those online courses. They're not very good." Well, certainly the first generation of them were pretty primitive. They were still better than nothing for people whose German class had been cut or economics class had been cut. But the current generation is so conspicuously getting better, the online software is, and we're on the verge of what you might think of the 3.0 generation of it, where it's getting more robust, more imaginative, more colorful, more differentiated by learning style, more interactive. So you can begin to see the curve as the disruption that didn't look so good and wasn't all that well received suddenly accelerating into something that is a very powerful competitor.
Quite right. And one of the things, actually, Paul, that's interesting to add from there is one of the reasons I think we wrote the book, right, Kurt, is to say to the software makers, hey, this is a really exciting, disruptive path you're on, but you should wake up to the reality that students learn in different ways. You shouldn't look like the traditional classroom with the traditional textbook that just has been moved online. This is your opportunity.
Right, exactly.
Good. And it'll be good to see more of them seize that opportunity. Absolutely. Good. With the book, you focus down on compulsory education, K through 12 or K through 14. Let's move on a little bit and try and apply some of those ideas to the next level up, universities and colleges. So in that world, we have some very bright lights, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, Stanford, etc. Now, are they higher education's equivalent of those older companies like, say, DEC or Digital, depending upon what they were called at the time, waiting to be disrupted?
Well, I guess since I went to the Harvard Business School, maybe I should try to answer that one, right?
Be very careful.
I have to be, it's true. I have to be careful because they don't want us to publish it on the campus there, that's for sure. But the Harvard Business School is, in fact, being disrupted, and that's right on. And you see it in all sorts of veins, because when you think about what the job of management or business education is, there's actually several jobs, from I just want to learn this concept so I can, you know, run my business better, to I want to be a great general manager, to I just need credentials for the next promotion, and so on and so on. And you see corporate universities popping up pretty rapidly, such as Motorola University in Crotonville, and et cetera, that are starting to take on those jobs more and more. And then you look at the business model of Harvard Business School, and you realize, well, gosh, they're really dependent on executive education, which is employees basically from GE and Motorola coming over and paying a lot of money to take programs at Harvard, and that funds professors' research and subsidizes MBA students and so on. And that market is rapidly moving over to corporate universities, and they're just moving up market rapidly. You also see disruptions in the business school market from the online players that are starting to come up that people have thought of as crummy, but Phoenix, University of Phoenix, is improving quite rapidly. And you've also seen part-time MBAs for some time as a low-end disruptor for people who just say, gosh, it's not worth paying $65,000 a year to go to business school, give up my salary, when I know I'm going to go into the workforce and half the companies I might want to work for can't even afford the salary it would take to get me out of debt. So it's actually a serious situation for the business school.
Yeah, and one of the things we've not talked much about is the economics and the sustainability of the present arrangements. And whether you're talking about high schools that cannot afford the breadth of the curriculum they once offered, or talk about higher education, if you just slice off the private side of that, the only thing in the United States economy with a higher inflation rate over the last two decades than healthcare has been private school tuition. And I think most people in that business realize that there is a wall they are going to hit at some point, and this disruption is coming up right alongside.
Ooh. that could be challenging. I guess one of the problems we're seeing, throughout the book, talking about that compulsory education phase, you talk about the need to move towards individualized learning and providing more and more choice and more that's tailored to the individual student. Looking from my perspective, having gone to a university where I think there were 12 of us in the year, and looking at it now, where the numbers are just ramping up at a quite phenomenal rate. You know, there's more and more government incentive for an increasing number of the population to go to university. There's more and more of a requirement in terms of future employment to come out with a degree. And all the time universities are trying to decrease their costs. So actually they're becoming more like the schools you talk about at the start of the book, you know, sort of cramming hundreds into a lecture hall and just lecturing at them, and less like the individualized learning experiences that they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. So is that a problem to then move them on to back to individualized learning when all of the drivers upon them are forcing them towards sort of mass consumption?
You know, well, I think that's one. Go ahead, Kurt.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I'd had a conversation with a university president about a month ago who was telling me about this just combat he's been in for the last 5 years with the members of the science faculty because they were tearing down an old building that needed to go, and they were in the process of trying to design the new facility. And the faculty wanted to design it in the old way, just kind of divide up the space into classrooms and have a few labs. And he was arguing with them, saying, no, guys, the world has changed. Kids don't learn that way anymore. We need to design this for flexibility, for customization, and sure, have a few spaces where people can gather and be face-to-face. Well, it is a war that's going on within that industry right now.
Yeah, and I would say that's why I think it's unlikely that those established players in the higher education market are the ones that are probably going to bring about this customization, because their processes and economics are designed that they do a lot better, as you said, if they bring just a lot more kids through and ship them out after the year, or 4 years rather. And so it's hard to expect them to be the ones probably to catch the wave and really customize the education. At the same time, though, you see a lot of disruptive products in higher ed starting to come up with very different labor models that are either tutor-based or much smaller classes or a variety of schematics. And if you look at those, you say, hey, there's some hope on the horizon, and we could solve the cost problem and the labor model problem so that you could have far more customization.
Yeah, you might emerge not ever knowing what a Bunsen burner smells like, but it's pretty hard to beat the quality of virtual chem lab.
Yeah, that's true. It is very good. Now, will the turkeys on the faculty ever vote for Christmas?
Well, if they were smart, they would. But, you know, that's obviously the big challenge at the leading institutions and a lot of the state universities here. Is getting them to see that precipice, as I think Kurt might call it, and making the big leap. What we've encouraged at Harvard Business School is to really use the publishing arm to set up a totally independent unit, basically, in the business school, that they can be sort of the intel inside, if you will, of all these emerging programs, so that at least they'll still be using Harvard Business School content. Whether that will actually happen or not, I don't know. But it's the track record is not necessarily encouraging, and at the same time, certainly K-12 education is a very regulated space. Higher education is far less so. The main regulations are around accreditation and things of that sort. But it makes it a much more robust marketplace for disruption, and you see it a lot in adult learning and things of that nature.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. So we are seeing some large-scale programs in the higher education space. We're seeing things like OpenCourseWare. We're seeing things like iTunes U, you know, where existing course material from these existing institutions is being made available freely online. Is that disruptive, or is it just a sustaining innovation?
My gut is that it's a sustaining play ultimately, and the reason I say that is MIT, which is famous for putting all of their lectures online and so forth, all the courses, they haven't really set up a new business model that can take in different students and so forth. They're just, you know, throwing it out there open willy-nilly, and they're not really redesigning something. What I think you've pointed out actually in one of your blogs is that iTunes U, while it may be sort of a sustaining play, it actually may be an enabler, though, for other disruptions, as you can pull in the lecture material, and so it may allow disruptors to make progress and bring in higher quality stuff faster. And I think that's an interesting question, whether it could be used in that way.
So that would be, you know, as we were discussing over the weekend in blog posts, that would be sort of community colleges, perhaps, providing access to a Clayton Christensen lecture from Harvard, but at community college tuition prices rather than Harvard tuition prices.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And community colleges are a classic disruption. They offer a low-cost alternative to four-year universities, and they measure quality on different axes, not by the selectiveness of admissions or the earning power of graduates, but by factors such as job placement rates and the convenience of access to classes. And they often have smaller class sizes. And I would Kurt can probably talk a lot more about them, but they are classic disruptors.
Kurt?
I could just add that one thing that's been rippling through these last few minutes of our discussion, but we haven't made very explicit, is that whether you're talking about community colleges or any other kind of disruption, it always takes place in what you must think of as separate space. Every one of the industry examples that we offered happened over here in separate space from the dominant incumbent player in the industry. And we tried to point this book toward educators in part to say, you can either sit on the sidelines and watch this happen to you, or you could make an attempt to manage your own disruption. But if you do that, the tuition for that play is you've got to have the courage and the vision to create genuinely separate space and allow authentically autonomous new schools to be created, and not smother them with your culture, your bureaucracy, your processes, your control mechanisms. That can happen, but it does require very unusual courage and will, because it's got to be really separate space.
You know, Paul, we've been a little bit doom and gloom, and I think that's just because there is a lot of gravity to the situation. But, of course, we wrote the book so we could help people see that. One of the interesting things, actually, there is an example, I think, of a university that may be making the shift, or at least trying. It's called Tiffin University, and they're trying a new model for an online two-year degree program. And it looks like they've separated it out. Whether it's enough so or not, I don't know. But it's an intriguing thing that totally different value proposition from the normal four-year university. And so that'll be interesting to see how that grabs and pulls in the market.
Absolutely. And presumably, you know, in setting up this separate space, going back a little bit to the doom and gloom, you have to be prepared to accept that it could undermine you, it could undercut you.
That's exactly right. You have to be willing to say, hey, this could cannibalize our existing business. And there's a story up where Kurt's from that's just perfect for that. It's the story of Dayton Hudson, which was a department store, and they were disrupted by the low-end discount stores like Walmart, Kmart, and, of course, Target. And Target was actually an autonomous business unit that Dayton Hudson set up with the mission to do business as best as you can and ultimately put us out of business, and that's what they did. But, of course, Target has become very successful in the United States as a low-end disruption.
Yeah, and the companion force that we mentioned maybe less often, in addition to the separate space, is the tool of power. And we just mentioned it by implication a couple of times. Those Dayton Hudson executives didn't hold a Democratic election to decide whether to create Target as a separate and autonomous unit. They just said, we're going to do it. And in the kind of industry that schools are, it's important for somebody to use the power tool and say, in order to manage our own disruption, we are going to create this separate space, and it's not up for referendum.
And it'll be a brave school board leader who does it.
Absolutely.
The first one will be brave, the second one will be following, and the third and fourth will be fine.
Well, that's probably just describing one district.
yes, probably. So we were talking about the ways in which a community college, for example, might make use of these high-profile lectures from Harvard and Stanford and the like. So the community colleges and the lower-end universities, there's a perfect opportunity for them to seize this disruption and to grow on the back of it. Harvard, Stanford, Cambridge and the like will probably be okay for a while, even if they just ride on the back of their endowments. What about everyone else in the middle? They're done for, aren't they?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, the universities in the middle could go up market, and that would be a natural response. And you've seen some of them do that as they've tried to make their admissions more selective and so forth. But yeah, I think there's likely to be a deep hollowing out of the higher ed market in that particular sphere as these lower cost and alternatives start to achieve scale and do things very differently. It's interesting, a place like Harvard College might be okay for the time being because no one's really started to disrupt one of their jobs, which is the whole socialization, let me live and sort of find myself in these 4 years job that we ascribe to universities. Right, and so the brand, and as a result, survives longer as long as they continue to carve that out. But brands, of course, can get disrupted too. And you can imagine when Crotonville starts putting out more Fortune 500 CEOs than Harvard Business School does, which is close to happening, that people might start seeing it in a different light.
I mean, one way to pose the question, Paul, is what happens when over half of all the enrollments occur online, and that's a plausible proposition. What happens then to all those ones in the middle?
Yeah, indeed. Is it a bad thing then, this polarization of the market that we're alluding to, or is it other than for the faculty whose jobs are disrupted? Presumably for everyone else, it's giving them a choice and it's creating a market and allowing that market to decide.
I think that's exactly right, and exactly what we say. What we would say is, you know, disruptions aren't necessarily pleasant things for the individual organization that gets disrupted, but it's really a positive force in the marketplace and for people's lives, which is the fundamental thing we're concerned about in this space, because it gives them more options that's more customized for them at lower prices and just allows a lot more of them to partake in the way that they would like to, and that's just a great thing for everyone. If we can all consume more education, I think we'd all be happy with that.
Do we need a university to do that, or is there potential actually for the notion of a four-year degree to be as disrupted as you were suggesting that places like TIFFIN are beginning to do?
It's an interesting question. Those places may also go up market to themselves and start with a two-year degree, figure out how to do it less expensive, feed students into four-year schools, which is the trend right now of community colleges, how they work. And then they may expand over time and say, you know, hey, don't worry about teaching those juniors either. We'll do that too. Stay with your sports teams. And so it could evolve that way. I think it's hard to say.
Okay. So let's imagine for a moment that the sorts of disruption the book was talking about and the sorts of disruption we've been talking about, with more of a focus on individual choice and targeted solutions for the student, let's imagine that some of that has come to pass. What does a disrupted higher education look like? What does the Harvard Business School look like once it's been disrupted?
That's a good question. Well, if we have the foresight to catch it, then the Harvard Business School hopefully will, as I said before, have made all of their courses very easy to access and allow people that are not Clay Christensen to teach disruptive innovation just as good as he would. And so you could go on there and say, hey, I'm teaching a course at my little university or my corporation or whatever, my training program, and I just need to teach someone how to catch disruption, something, just one or two lessons, that's all what we have time for. And you'd sort of type that in and you'd say, I'm not a case teacher, but I can do some moderate teaching if I stand up at the blackboard and my students learn best through this method. And you type that in and the Harvard Business School would sort of, the publishing website would do some computations and spit out a couple cases with some lesson plans and some tips for how to, so you could teach that course. That would be a great situation where HBS would still be the backbone.
Just allow your right brain to go a little bit crazy and think about what could happen. This is way beyond the envelope of the book, of course. But it's not that hard to imagine a world in which somebody finds one of these big brokering organizations that may exist by then, which will help you walk through online how you match up what you really are interested in and would like to do with what it takes in the way of knowledge and capacity to be able to do that. And then once you get that decided, shows you where the best opportunities are for learning how to do that. And then off stuff you could do virtually and online, and maybe an assortment of places to go for face-to-face kind of instruction. And then negotiates for you a degree-granting situation from the institution of your choice, and then offers to do your resume, get you placed. I mean, you can see a hybrid kind of polyglot, really mixed-up model compared to the very standard, conventional thing inside of Walls and Ivy that we have today.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think you're right on, Kurt. And there's some companies already doing stuff like this. Straighter Line, which is a product out of a company called Smart Thinking, is really doing some stuff just basically like what Kurt just described, where you they've basically aggregated all the tutors across the world, and so you as a student in a higher education institution can pay just for your tutoring sessions at a very cheap rate, sort of like a call center almost. And Straighter Line basically becomes a lead generator for degree-granting universities, and then they've been able to do an end-around around the accreditation process that way, so that they can offer general education courses. And so McGraw-Hill and a few other content people can put up their stuff. You can access it through there. You have a learning management system like a Blackboard that helps you navigate the system. And then you have a question on something, and you just get on the phone or your email or your IM, and you call up a tutor on Smart Thinking, and it only takes them 2 minutes to respond to you, 14 hours to turn around a paper to you, and you just get unbelievable one-on-one time for as much as you need. So it totally changes it from where now it's how much time does my teacher have for me to how much time do I actually need. And just like Kurt said, I think over time you'll see a menu of options that with systems that really help you navigate that system.
Presumably there are then questions to ask about how that gets paid for. Presumably with Smart Thinking you're effectively paying by the hour or by the minute, are you, for their time?
So the new model with Straighter Line is actually it's by course, and so it's $399 per course, or they're going to do a $99, I think, per month subscription fee or something like that. And so in many cases, the universities will probably pick this up because they're spending an inordinate amount of money right now trying to get students to come into them. And so the lead generation activity is just so expensive that they would be thrilled to partner up with someone like Smart Thinking who could just transfer credit straight into their institution, like Kurt suggested.
But of course, to the typical balding, bespectacled, professor in the tweedy jacket with the leather patches on the elbows, this must really sound like barbarians at the gate.
Yes.
Pretty scary.
Yes. Are there ways to help those traditional members of the institution, or do we just wait for them to retire?
No, I think we would love to try to help them, and you know, the sooner more people can catch the wave and offer customized learning opportunities in different formats and different ways, you know, the better, right? So I think they could, and through education and giving people a common language to frame the problem and the threats and the opportunities and see those threats actually as opportunities, they could really see the world in a different way and do some neat things, I think.
Okay, good. I'm conscious of the time, unfortunately. I'm having a great time, but we are getting short on time. So just before we finish off, I'm going to ask each of you if you have any closing remarks to make. And I'll go first to Michael. Do you have anything to say to finish off?
Sure. I mean, I think we've had it's been obviously a very interesting discussion, and we've thrown a lot of darts at the wall and gone off in some loops that have been somewhat depressing. But I think as Kurt, Clay, and myself would quickly say, one of the reasons we wrote this book and we're out there is because we want everyone to participate in this revitalization and this disruption themselves so that we can all catch the wave. And really the mission of Clay's work since the Innovator Solution has been to say, hey, you are the giant that typically got disrupted, but how can you be part of that innovation process now so you can catch the next wave? And that's something that we really want to do too, so that we do it in great ways that benefit everyone.
Good. Thank you.
I would agree with that and say we did set out to write an inherently optimistic book, and I think we did. And even though the title, Disrupting Class, may seem unsettling at first, it really does, as Michael said, represent an opportunity, and it's good news if you recognize what's coming and you can actually manage your own destiny with it. We'd also be remiss if we don't say that you can find the book on Amazon.com at a ridiculously low price, and you really ought to buy it and read it.
I would second that, and I get no royalties.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. It's been a very interesting call.
Pleasure.
And I look forward to seeing where we go from here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.